Chapter 4. The short, warm summer night went by full of the thump and rattle of the presses, shouting, laughter, orating. They printed up a new sheet over the journal's name and headed in 72-point type, Revolution. The shop was snowed under with it. It was all over the streets. Men and horses were found to carry it to the provinces. It announced what they knew about the Paris Revolution and stated that the National Assembly was remaining in session to consider the urgent questions of relations with the new government of France, tax control, and succession to the throne of the kingdom. Lots of fuses to that bomb, Bellave said when he read it. He and Aragon had been about the city all night, going from one deputy's house to another, to inform them that the assembly would meet as usual at 9 tomorrow. Leaving the printer's shop, Itari went with him and San Giusto to Cathedral Square, which had been the centre of agitation during the night. In the cool of August dawn, under a high, cloud-brindled, colourless sky, the square looked immense and empty. The cathedral stood indifferent as a mountain, intent only on holding up its ponderous, delicate towers and ranks of stone saints and kings. They went on to the Elena Prada. Down the mall, one behind the other, stood the cavalry of the palace guard, the men sallow and sleepy on tall horses. Behind them, on the lawns, under the trees, swarmed an aimless crowd, thousands of people drifting, dispersing, regathering. The constant movement and the low but immense sound of the voices of the crowd was improbable, bewildering, in the austere and indrawn hour of dawn. Itali had meant to go on to Carante's flat for a few hours' sleep, but stayed with the others in the crowd. Bellave went to buy bread and cheese, since they were hungry. He went off and came back at a run, fearing something momentous would happen while he was gone 10 minutes. The sky grew lighter, higher. Sunlight touched the crowns of the chestnuts. Nothing momentous had occurred but sunrise. It became a warm August morning. The crowd, grown enormous, now covered all the lawns beneath the grave, ignorant trees. Itali and the other two had slowly pushed their way along the front of the crowd to the fence surrounding the gravelled area before the palace, and could see and hear the deputies on the left, gathered on the mall in front of the gates, arguing with officers of the guard. Itali was not paying much attention, as he was distracted by the increasing pressure and aimless turbulence of the crowd, and also was extremely sleepy. "There's Liven," Bellave said, "left-wing noble from the Sorvena." "They talked about him there. He hasn't attended all month," Itali said, and yawned till his eyes watered and he could not see the big, fair young man who was saying, "Herr Colonel, you have no authority to keep the gates locked. The assembly room belongs to the assembly." "Distinguished sir, there has been no change in our orders," the colonel of militia said for the 10th time. "You had best send to the Rook Palace requesting a change in your orders, Herr Colonel," Leven said loudly. And the crowd, pressed against the fence a few feet from him, shouted in support. San Giusto nudged Itali. "Look, they catch two crows." Two clerical deputies, who had come up the mall out of curiosity, were trying to depart and found the crowd closed across their way and jeering. They hesitated and came back to join the 40 or 50 Liberal deputies waiting in front of the iron gates. More jeers and insults rang up and down the edges of the mall, now continuously walled with men. The guardsmen's horses shifted feet. One tossed its head up and down until controlled. There was a sudden outbreak of shouts and cheers. Hats and caps flew up into the sunlight. A gig came rolling up the gravel of the mall between the tall horses and the crowd walls. "Who is the little old man?" San Giusto asked, as the cheering broke out all around them. "Prince Mogesca, Matthias Sovenska's cousin. Nobilissimus. Took some courage to come here. Long live Mogesca!" Itali shouted, swept up by the crowd's enthusiasm. "Long live Mogesca!" The prince got out of his gig. A pinched, brusque, neat, very old man, and said to Aragon and Leven, "Good morning, gentlemen. Why are the palace gates shut in our faces?" Himself caught by the affronted, restless, lively temper of the crowd. But they waited. 10 o'clock struck on the deep bell of the cathedral. 80 deputies stood on the sun-white gravel before the gates. Prince Mogesca had invited an elderly priest to sit in his gig. "Hot work, this, for old men," he said, and sat on, stiff and speckless in the blazing light. Stefan Aragon was always near the gig, even held the horse, made nervous by the crowd. He was heliotropic, drawn to power, as his own power of winning men was less a gift than a deficiency. He could not stand alone. Yet he knew far better than Mogesca or Leven or the colonel of the militia what power was. He knew himself to be the focus of the crowd, the soul of this immense, conglomerate, temporary entity. When he chose to act, they would act. Itali, bored, thirsty and half asleep, shifted from one foot to the other because both hurt. He was staring at the mansards of the palace against the hazy sky, counting windows, when abruptly he felt himself lifted off his feet, picked up and cried out, "What is it?" in a surge of excitement. He pushed and was pushed. They were no longer standing still, no longer waiting. He heard a guardsman bawling an order in German about the relief of every second man, and the men around him shouting, "What is it? They're going to fire!" Aragon was up above them all, up on one of the cannon that flanked the iron gates, shouting, pointing to the palace. The noise was unbelievable. He could not believe that mere men could make such a noise. Yet through it, he heard clearly a different sound. Tat-tat, a remote cross, spinsterish voice, and then the scream of a panicked horse. They were pushing, forcing, ground and sucked step by step out of sunlight into booming corridors, marble underfoot, garlands of roses on the ceilings overhead. Then, all at once, the ceiling rose up very high, and there was air and room to breathe. They were in the assembly room. Itali found he was close, arm-linked with San Giusto, and began to comprehend that he with the crowd had forced their way into the palace. Aragon was there, up on the platform, shouting orders, trying to gather the deputies out of the mob. Itali rubbed his arms, which were sore, rubbed sweat off his forehead, stared around him. "Let's get out of this. Up to the gallery," he said, and found himself hoarse, as if he'd been shouting for a long time. Perhaps he had. He didn't know. They tried to get to the side door that led to the reporter's gallery, but were stopped at once by a group coming in, men carrying heavy sacks. The sacks were put down beside the rostrum. The noise of voices in the huge room sank steadily, like waters at ebb. The rostrum was the center of the hush. With all the rest, Itari and San Giusto came past and saw that the sacks were dead men. The face of one of them had been shot off. His hands stuck out from his cuffs, stiff and posed, and his cracked shoes stuck up in the same way. The ear was visible, normal, intact, a man's ear, just below the bright red porridge of the face. The other man, middle-aged, did not look dead, but lay there, startled, with open eyes. Above that, at the rostrum, they saw a blonde, young, strong face, Liv Enns. He was speaking in a clear voice. "These two, and the others killed, paid a debt not owing. No more. We are not buying our country, but claiming it as our inheritance, ours by right. Remember that. There is no need for violence, no need for sacrifice. We are the creditors, not the debtors." Tears ran down Itali's face as he stood there, then stopped as suddenly as they'd started. He and the Italian began again to try to make their way to the side door and the gallery, but they never got there. For 6 hours, they stood side by side against the back wall of the assembly room, while the assembly, 130 deputies, among thousands of others, held session. They voted to speak their own language in debate, voted this and all decrees subject to validation by the king alone, voted congratulations in the nation's name to the new king of France, though they did not know who he was, the Duke of Bordeaux or Louis-Philippe of Orleans, and rumors now claimed Lafayette as the president of a new French republic. "They'll pick Louis-Philippe," San Giusto said. "For a whole generation, the old mushroom has been waiting, waiting. All things come to him who waits." Itali nodded, not listening. He listened with strained attention to each speaker, but found it difficult to understand or remember what they said. Prince Modjeska now had the floor. His brusque, precise voice trembled with effort and age. "I will give my allegiance to the house of the Slovenskas, as did my ancestors and yours. I will do so with joy when the time comes. But the time has not come. We can call Matthias Slovenska king, but can we crown him? Can we defend him? Metternich will hear our requests, for he needs peace, but he will not listen to our defiance. We have not the strength to defy that power. For the king's own sake, I beg you to wait in determination, not to act rashly." And all this seemed clear and true to Itali, until Aragon and others replied and proved with equal clarity that the only hope lay in rapid action, the installation of Matthias Slovenska on the throne before Austria could intervene. Fait accompli, bloodless revolution, fatal procrastination, Austrian troops, uprising of all Europe. The words spun round, and all the time the point of all the words was incomprehensible, was missing. It was 5 o'clock. Itali startled himself awake from a momentary standing doze and said, "Let's get out of here, Francesco." Again, they did not get where they were headed. A deputation from the Rook Palace had just come in. A dozen palace guards, Raskineska, the Minister of Finance, and the Prime Minister Cornelius, went towards the rostrum, spoke to Leven and Oregon, smiled his pleasant, bland smile. Gentlemen, thank you for permitting me to interrupt your debate. I bear a message to you from the Sovereign. Her Grace regrets the disappointment caused by the adjournment of session of the National Assembly and, tentative to the wishes of her people, will tomorrow request the reconvocation of the Assembly on Monday next. She has asked me to notify the present gathering that fraternal greetings have been sent to King Louis-Philippe of France, and to thank them for their share in maintaining law and order in the city during the day, trusting that such order will continue without incident, and that the... Without incident? What about the men shot down this morning? The interruption from the floor set off a roar of voices, a surge towards the platform, checked by Oregon shouting out, "This is not a gathering. This is the Assembly of the Nation. Tell the Duchess that until King Matthias reaches Krasnoy, the Sovereign is here, in this hall. Tell her that peace and order depend on her submission to us, the government, and the kingdom." Cornelius looked at him, looked around and shrugged. "This is simply folly," he said. He turned to go, and because he was decisive, and the crowd was more intent upon the speaker, he got out with the chalk-faced Raskineska and the dozen guardsmen. "The die is cast!" Oregon was roaring. The hall seethed fantastically in turmoil, frenzy. "Come along, come along," San Giusto said. And this time they got out and stood dazed outside the palace in the still, clear evening air. At midnight, Itali was standing in the darkness on Ebrahui Street, a block from Rook Square, sucking one of his finger joints that had been scraped raw in handling cobblestones, and carefully studying the torchlit barrier that had been raised across the street where it debouched into the square. Two men near him were arguing in a dreary, savage monotone. He could not distinguish one voice from the other. 3,000 militia, 3 miles downriver at Basri. We've got the route cut off. Count on the militia joining us. Who says they will? They've got the guns. The guns. Still nearer him, two women sat on the curbstone, one suckling a baby, and they spoke now and then. "So then I told him. I forgot the eggs. I told him." "Oh, aye, Mother of God. What can you do at a time like this?" One sighed. One laughed. "Save up and wait, I told him." Men ran by up the street, followed by a queer, hollow, roaring sound. A group of 30 or more came pulling and pushing a black thing up the street towards the barricade, a cannon. The iron wheels made a gobbling roar on the stones. Torches flared around, making the shadows lurch and fly. Itali looked down in the torchlight. The baby was very young. Its head, lying on the mother's bare arm, was unbelievably small. After the cannon had gone by, he could hear the small, smacking noises the baby made in sucking. The woman's dry, easy voices. "So I says, 'Oh, don't tell me, you old sow. I didn't hatch out last week.' And the men arguing. The streets, the guns." He went on up the street to the barricade and rejoined San Giusto there. It took a long time to get the cannon in place, and the barrier rebuilt around it. Men kept coming to see it, to give advice on loading and firing, to touch it. Of all the men behind the Ebroi street barricade, one in 25 or 30 had a gun. Most of the Novesma Verba men were there, but not Carante. Some said he was still with the assembly. Others, that he was on the Gulhelm street barricade. Itari clambered up to the slanting top of the barrier over the cannon and looked down on Rook Square. In the uneasy dimness of torches, stars, window light from the palace, the big cobbled square sloped slightly downward from the iron palisades of the palace. Empty. It was empty all night. Several men pulled a couple of the mattresses, ladders, shot stoppers on the barricade, till they could lie down on them. San Giusto and Itari lay side by side, their chins on their arms, watching the palace. It was about 40 hours since they'd had any sleep. At long intervals, they spoke to each other. What's that? On the next barricade north, the Palaise Street, there was something going on. Something was being set up or put in place. Got another cannon? No, it sticks up in the air. They could not make out what it was in the uncertain torchlight. Itali put his head down on his arms. He dreamed and waked in starts, and waking did not know what he'd dreamed. It was like being in a small boat on quiet water, trailing a hand over the edge, so that sometimes the waves touch it, sometimes not. One does not know if one is touching air or water. Vernoy climbed up beside them. He shook Itari gently, offered him something, bending down his tired, pleasant young face. He had come by a hat full of apples down in the ghetto. They all sat up and munched apples, were cheered by eating, talked a little. What do you think they'll do come daylight, Sorde? Wait. I'll think they'll try to blow us up. The whole city. They'll do better to wait for the militia. Apple, Francesco. But San Giusto had gone back to sleep. Not long till light now, Itali said softly. And then they were all silent for a long time. Northwest, over the roofs, a pink glow flickered, faded, flickered again. A fire that got out of hand. There had been a lot burning in the old quarter and other districts. The pink glow faded. The few lighted windows of the Rook looked wan. Itali looked up. The sky was grey. It was dawn. He woke wide awake, turned over, and sat up on the steep-set mattress, looking eastward over Ebroi Street, that dropped away sharply downhill, and over the ghetto, lying many-roofed, jumbled, shadowy, between the barricade and the river. To the left rose the hill of the university, on the far side of which he'd used to live. There, on the highest point in the city, the cross on the spire of the university chapel, light struck, trembled, steadied. Gold crept down the spire, down chimney stacks and roofs of houses crowded rank above rank on the hill. He turned again and saw the battlements of the palace tawny red, alive against the dead blue-grey of the western sky. It was a fine summer morning. He was no longer tired, only very hungry, and though he was excited, his thoughts no longer rushed, but came simple, detached, concrete. Thoughts of what the men in the besieged palace were probably planning. Thoughts of people out in the suburbs going about their business and wondering what was going on inside the city. Thoughts of what it would be like to be shot down in the street, the stones against his hands and face. He loved Krasnoy. He loved the steep, shadowy roofs, beneath which people still lay asleep. The sunlit hill, the old palace, fierce red in the sunlight, the streets and the stones of the streets. It was his city, his people, his day. "I wish I could shave," he said aloud. And San Giusto nodded and yawned. They stood up, stretching, and balanced on the crown of the barricade between the fortress and the risen sun. With the act of standing up, the simplification, the clarification of thought and feeling was perfected. Itali was completely happy, standing there, empty-handed, beside his friend in the indifferent calm of the morning. He had nothing left in the world but the day's light. No weapon, no shelter, no future. It was for this he had lived and waited. Almost tenderly, he thought of the soldiers sweating inside their stone walls there. What was there to worry about? It was the break of day, and standing up there, he could have crowed like a cock at daybreak, in pure joy, in celebration of the light. He glanced at his friend and said, with his hands in his pockets, smiling irrepressibly, "Do you believe in God, Francesco?" "Of course. Don't you?" "No, thank God." San Giusto shook his head. He was exhilarated, but not exultant. Being busy with a premonition amounting to certainty that he was going to get killed today. Freedom was freedom, and often enough he had honestly wished for the privilege of such a death. And yet now it came to the point he was bitter that he could not die for his own country, on his own ground. He was homesick. "The light shineth in the darkness," Itali sang aloud, "and the darkness comprehendeth it not." San Giusto laughed at the words, and the cock crow tune. Brelave climbed up beside them, looked around, sat down, and took off his shoe. "Had a rock in here all night," he explained. "Look at that hole in my stocking." "You ought to marry. Get your stockings down." "Not till I can marry a countess, like young Livia," Brelave said, cocking his sharp, dark face up at Itali. "Or a baroness, at least." "She won't darn your stockings. Look there." On the Palazzo Street barricade, a long pole had been set up, and on it hung, almost unmoving in the quiet air, a red and blue flag. All the men looked at the flag. None of them had seen it raised for 18 years. Most were too young to remember ever having seen it. "I'm going round to see if Carante's at Wilhelm Street," Bellave said. Itali stopped him as he started to climb down. "Listen, if you find Givan, tell him we should all try to meet tonight at the Verba office, I suppose." "That's no good if things go badly." "At Haleska's, then." "All right." "That should do. See you in half an hour. Don't wait breakfast for me." Bellave went off. The others stood talking, waiting. A third of Rook Square now was sunlit. Since he could not cross the square, Breleve had to make a long semicircle to get round to Gulhelm Street. Coming up it, two blocks from the square, he ran into a crowd. Civilians surrounding men in uniform. Breleve could see the white and gold of militia uniforms, but could not make out how many soldiers there were. Evidently, a detachment had been sent from the garrison at Bazare to make contact with the Rook guards. A lieutenant and a captain argued with the chiefs of the barricade. The men around Breleve were pushy and restless, crowding in thicker every moment, itching to get their hands on the soldiers' guns. They shouted at their spokesman and at the officers. There was an effort to clear a passage down the street away from the palace, and Breleve heard one of the barricade chiefs, a working man in his 40s, telling the captain with exasperation and despair, "Get your men out now! Get them out!" The captain took offense. "We shall march unto the palace," he said in his German accent, and turned to give the order. Breleve was knocked right off his feet and carried forward some way, suffocated by the pressure of the mob, kicking out like a horse and grabbing for any support. What he had hold of when the pressure lessened was a militiaman's shoulder strap. He and the soldier stared at each other, their frightened faces 6 inches apart, while a tremendous continuous noise and the rocking, swaying pressure they were caught in confused them both. "They're firing," the soldier said, staring at Breleve. He tried to break away, and as he did, Breleve wrenched the musket out of his hands, using the gun stock as a ram to clear his way. He got out of the thick of the crowd. "I've got a gun, by God!" he yelled in triumph. He saw nobody to shoot at, and presently it occurred to him that he had no powder and shot. There was no more firing. The mob was scattering. What had happened, what had become of the troop of soldiers, Breleve did not understand. He saw men lying on the street, a dozen or more of them. There were white uniforms. There was the captain's gold braid on a body crushed together like a crumpled rag, beaten to death and trampled. Breleve stood staring at that terrible body. The crowd was streaming on up Gulhelm Street towards the barricade. They would have ammunition. He ran after them in a state of wild excitement, shouting, as several others were shouting, "Wait!" On the Ebroye Street barricade, they had heard, from the left, the small, dry sound of shots, and then a dull roar, like flooding water, heard far off. Then they saw a confused, dark tide come boiling up over the Gulhelm Street barrier and into Rook Square, now white with sunlight. As the crowd spread into the square, it thinned and looked sparse, aimless, like grasshoppers jumping in stubble, Itali thought. But it was hard not to join them, as other barricades began to spill over and feed running men back into the square. At the same time, he was yelling, "Keep back! Keep back!" to the men who, after waiting all night in the street, had heard gunfire and noise, and pressed forward, trying to see or get to the square. "Keep back! Keep the line!" His teeth jarred together, and he thought he was falling. "What was that?" he said to San Giusto, and then realized that the cannon, almost under his feet, had been fired. "Too much powder." San Giusto was growling in the smoke. Young Vernoy, pushed between them, leapt down from the barricade and vanished into the mob that now swarmed black across the square and against the iron fence around the palace. Another man tried to do the same, but Itari blocked his way and pushed him back and down with all his strength. "Keep back, damn you! Hold the barricade!" he shouted in fury, turning constantly to see what was happening on the square. The mob at the iron fence seethed, scaling it, swarming over it, smashing the gates, jamming at the palace doors. "They're in!" men shouted. And now Itari crouched, ready to jump down, to join. He could not hold himself back any longer. But as he paused, the whole scene seemed to pause. Little puffs of smoke, which had appeared a moment ago at the window slits of the palace, were evaporating quickly in the sunlit air. The enormous, steady crowd roar continued the same. But there was some change in the crowd's motion, a swaying and scattering. Men still pouring in from the barricades, but also a counter-movement, a press back towards the barricades, heavy and disordered, under the white puffs of smoke. Then there was a noise that seemed to stop everything, so that Itari crouched motionless, paralyzed. The cannons of the Rook. Nothing now but clambering men around him, men running, and the monstrous, endless sound. Then it ceased, and he heard human voices again, and saw the square emptied out. The crowds had shrunk away into separate swarms at each barricade. At the iron fence and on the sloping cobblestones, men were lying down here and there, as if waiting for something. Around the heads of some of these were streaks and blotches of bright red. And a man that came clambering up the barricade at Itali had a great smear of the same red stuff, like paint, over half his face and in his hair. "Leave your guns here at the barricade," San Giusto was saying, quiet as a butler taking coats. And several of the fugitives, who had muskets, handed them obediently to him. Here, take it," he was telling Itali. And Itali took the gun and shot back. Red coats of that same bright paint color now appeared filing rapidly out of the doors of the palace, which hung open like a black mouth. San Giusto lay down on their mattress and loaded his gun, aimed it, and fired it. Reloaded, aimed, fired. Itali imitated him, but had trouble with his gun, an Austrian army musket. He had never shot anything but a hunting piece. Presently, he lowered the loaded gun, got up and said, "Come on, Francesco." "Why?" "They've gone over the Palazzo Street barricade. They'll be coming around behind us. Let's head down towards the river." They started down Ebroi Street. Brelave had lost his gun and been knocked down twice getting out of Rook Square. He was now on a rooftop overlooking Palazzo Street, midway between the Rook and the Sinalia, along with six other men and a heap of paving blocks and furniture. The throng below were all civilians, angry after panic, but aimless in their anger. The palace guard had turned east and south to isolate the barricades and join up with the militia. Brelave scanned the crowd constantly, looking for a short, dark man and two tall ones. Carante, Sode, San Giusto. They could be anywhere. They could be lying dead on Rook Square. He was sore, sick, and wrathful. A dozen times he thought he saw one of their faces, then lost it, or saw it was a stranger's. A spatter of gunfire from the south. He listened and watched. If he believed those three were dead, he would give up, run home. He looked about the quiet rooftops in the morning sunshine, hating the impassioned, hysterical city, the crowds below him. If Sorde and Carente were dead, he would as soon throw himself over with the paving blocks they had carried up here to dump on the soldiers when they came by. It was not hope that kept him there, in control of himself and of his little rooftop mob. It was the thought of his friends. He had a hopeful spirit, but deeper in him than any conviction lay loyalty, and on that bedrock, obstinate and ironic, he waited. Hooves were clattering by on Ebrioi Street, while Itali and San Giusto stood in the darkness inside an arched doorway in the courtyard of a tenement block. The squad passed by, going up the street towards the Rook. As San Giusto and then Itali came out of hiding, a stooped young woman appeared in the court, two little children huddling close to her. She stood still, looking at them. "Can you give us water?" Itali said. She nodded, returned in silence with the children to a dark staircase, and came back with a dipper so that the two men could drink from the covered well in the courtyard. She stood watching them, her face quiet, and when Itali thanked her, she said, "Go to Mendel's, the butcher's. The men have gone there." So they went, and found in the yard, behind a kosher butcher's shop, under silent, shuttered tenements, and the blank back wall of a synagogue, a couple of dozen Jews planning the ghetto's part in the insurrection. They were calm and methodical. One, a man in his 30s, with beautiful, weary eyes, dominated the discussion by natural authority, and because he had a good supply of powder and shot for their empty guns. Itali heard him called Moshe, and called him so, never learning his last name. Under his direction, they occupied a block of rooftops on Ebrioi Street. Presently, a file of the red-coated guards appeared, coming down from the Rook, on shining restive horses. The men on the roofs opened fire, a dry clatter of cracks and bangs, foolish and exciting to hear as firecrackers. There was shouting. Horses galloped. Others with empty saddles neighed, ran down the street, stopped with their reins dragging, and looking nervously, peaceably around. In the pause that followed, Itali said to Moshe beside him, "Where did you come by all this ammunition?" "Last night, when we burned the old armory on Gelder Street." "What are you in this for, Moshe?" "Because where we stand, any change is the better," the Jew said, tapping his flask to loosen the packed powder. He glanced aside at Itali. "I could ask, what are you in this for?" "I like the open air." "It's a game to you." "No, it's not a game." "Eight," San Giusto said, counting the men they had killed in the firecracker burst. His mouth was tense, and he squinted a little, so he did not look like himself. Far up at the head of the street, where the mounted troop had retreated on the broken barricade, several small figures had appeared. One raised a megaphone, and they heard a thin, bawling voice. "Lay down all weapons, and proceed to your houses. 4 hours. Proceed to your... General amnesty is granted for 4 hours. Shots were fired from a rooftop. The small figures vanished. During the morning, the ghetto was not cut off, and men came through constantly with news of fighting on Palace Street and around the Elena Prada. For a long time after noon, nothing moved on the streets below Moishe's group. No one came from north or south. They waited, and their isolation became more and more certain and unbearable, driving them to reconnoitre recklessly, to try to provoke attack. Rook Square was now full of militiamen from the garrison downriver, and evidently was supplying troops to the northern part of the city. Moishe's group at last worked their way back to the rooftops over the barricade and began shooting. The troops got below them and fired the houses on the north side of Ebreoi Street. The wooden tenements burned like haystacks. The women who'd been hiding all day in the courts and rooms, ran out into the street, threw their belongings from windows. As they ran down the plank stairways, the insurgents passed children huddled waiting on the landings, and Moishe paused to call some urgent question to an old man, who for answer only shook his fist at them and cursed them with impotent hatred. They ran on, out of the buildings, across the sun-bright, crowded street, full of men and women, scared horses, broken bedsteads, falling beams of fire. Moishe led them in and out of the warren of the ghetto, coming back always to one place or another on Ebreoi Street, now deserted, scoured by troops of the mounted guards, where they could hold up for a while the windows of deserted rooms and shoot. But their shot was running out. There were always fewer of them at each run for cover, and in the last, they scattered. Only Itali and San Giusto kept together, following Moishe, and ran straight into a squad of militia, face to face, before any of them had time to lift a gun and fire. They clubbed their muskets, fought through, ran under fire, dodged into a house through a courtyard, ending up in the butcher's shop from behind which they had started that morning. They were not pursued. They waited there in hiding. Sounds from the street grew fewer, quieter. An hour went by. Itali got up from his crouching half-doze and went to the door of the shop. It was evening. The sky was clear greenish-blue at the upper end of the street, where they could see the squat north tower of the Rook. Gutted facades of houses across the way stared calmly at nothing. The air was smoky, warm and sweet. At his feet lay a bundle of clothing and an old shoe, dropped by a family fleeing the fire. "It looks like it's over," he said. San Giusto, then Moishe, came out beside him. In the last encounter, a soldier had brought a rifle butt down on San Giusto's hand, and the Italian sat down now on the curbstone, holding the injured hand against his thigh with a soft, groaning curse. Moishe went off to look at the body of an insurgent lying down the street near a dead soldier. He turned the head gently so that he could see the face, shrugged, came back. "Now what?" said Itali. "Now where?" "To the devil," San Giusto said in Italian. His hand already badly swollen, hurt increasingly. He was sick at heart. He had not been shot down and killed, but had to go on, go through it all over again, the long exile. "Oh, what a bitch of a life," he growled, this time in Piedmontese, and with his left hand whacked the butt of his empty gun on the stones of the street. "Home," Moshe said with his shrug. "And you?" Itali stood silent. "You're welcome to come with me," the Jew said coldly, ready for the rebuff. "Thank you," Itali said, turning to look at him. After this day, he knew this man's face and voice and fine stern eyes, as if he had known them all his life. Better than he might ever know any other face. But there was nothing between them but trust, everything, nothing. There was nothing left for them to say. "We have to try to find our group," Itali said. They parted with constrained words of farewell. Itali and San Giusto set off for Haleska's house, around the hill of the university, through River Quarter, past the cathedral and across its square. A dream walk, very long, through the red sunset, the dusk. They went tentatively at first. Later, they walked boldly. They were not halted, even by the militia posted in Cathedral Square. Troops of mounted guards passed clattering. Foot patrols of the city guard were posted here and there, but not in very great number than usual. The streets were emptier than usual, but not empty. There were other men in ones and twos walking, silent and not loitering. No women. A city without women. Itali and San Giusto talked as they went, sometimes quite coherently, discussing probable causes of the apparent amnesty, trying to construct some idea of what had gone on during the 2 days of insurrection. What might have happened in the Elena Prada while they were in the ghetto? What condition the assembly was now in? Itali was talkative, made jokes to cheer San Giusto up, and once remarked, "Well, work certain and reward seldom." In Sorden Street, he asked what day it was, and as they crossed Roche Street, he asked it again. "The 14th, San Giusto repeated. "I asked you that before, didn't I?" "Yes." "How's your hand?" "Like a fire." "It's not far now. We could..." He stopped himself. He had been about to say that perhaps they could stop a minute and rest. And that was foolish, with only 2 blocks left to walk. He stumbled. "We can stop," San Giusto said, his face drawn askew again. "No, it's just up the street," Itali said. "With any luck, Thomas will be there already." He thought he had said that before, too, and gave up talking. They came to the big, stately house, went under the portal with its coats of arms and caryatids, knocked, and were admitted by the liveried servant. They were crossing the salon to the library, where the lonely old man rose eager and alarmed to meet them, when Itali reached out for his companion's arm, stumbled again, and pitched down in a faint. San Giusto, not in much better condition himself, was utterly dismayed, alone among strangers. He fell on his knees beside Itali and tried to wake him, whispering in despair, "Listen, my dear, my friend, listen to me."